The more I dive into your life, you're quickly becoming the most interesting man alive.
When they wouldn't talk to me, I was like, they must be hiding something. There's a story there that might be worth telling.
Your lives are at stake. You are doing illegal things, and you have to, you know, develop gadgetry and special cameras, etc., to, you know, pull off what's sort of, an Ocean's 11 type heist.
Social change happens when you have 10% of the population 100% committed to the truth. When you combine the right words, the right moving pictures, with the right music and the right story, you have a recipe for being able to get into a person's brain and change not just the way they think, but the way they act.
If you're a fan of great documentaries and have enjoyed films like The Game Changers, The Cove, or Racing Extinction, then this episode is your jam, because my guest today is the multi-talented director behind those powerful projects, Louis Sohoyos. Prior to taking home an Academy Award for The Cove, Louis was one of the top still photographers in the world working for National Geographic, and he's currently serving as the executive director of the Oceanic Preservation Society. In addition to discussing his remarkable career, as well as his courageous filmmaking style that often places his life and that of his crew in mortal peril, this conversation covers his work as an ardent activist and environmentalist. It's about conservation, it's about sparking change, challenging societal norms, and the power of storytelling as this lever for awareness, for positive change and environmental preservation. Louis is truly the James Bond of filmmaking. It's an honor to know him, and it's a double honor to share his story and powerful perspective with you today. I mean, first of all, thank you for doing this. You know, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. You're a hard man to pin down. You're constantly traveling. You've got a slate of projects that you're, you know, always immersed in. And so, you know, I'm grateful to be able to grab your attention for a little bit here. How do you define for yourself, like, what it is that you do?
Well, I guess in the most simplistic terms, I'm a photographer slash filmmaker slash writer. But I'm really interested in using art, media, to scale social change. That's what I'm all about. You know, in this business, we're in, you know, outside of Hollywood now, most people, you know, most producers, directors, it's about $10 in a box of popcorn. It's about, you know, butts and seats and how much money can you get from the consumer. And I've always looked at the audience's minds and seats. How do you change a mind? Because the world's a screwed up place. It always has been to me. And this is my way to try to make it just incrementally, you know, a little bit better place. I look at, like, what I do is, it's like I'm a first mate with a drunken captain, and occasionally I get the controls, and while he's down sleeping it off, I can go nudge it on a different course. Mm-hmm. And that's by hijacking the public's imagination for something positive, to make positive changes that are scalable. And I've been fortunate to be able to do this with, you know, National Geographic, and later on when I got into films, you know, a fairly successful documentary career doing the same thing, but that's, you know, but ramping it up. And, you know, people always come to us after they see our film, say, the film changed my life. And as well, it's not by accident. I think about that, what we do, and how can you make almost every second up there count on the screen? Because you have a moment in silence to communicate, much like this, with your audience. And they're focused. They're not distracted, usually, by their phones. We're watching your film. They're, you know, and if you do a great job, they're not thinking about anything else. If you're doing your job, the whole world disappears for them, and they're focused in on your story. And so we're doing, you know, Mark Twain once said, the difference between the almost right word and the right word is the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning. And you're a writer. You understand that when you're sitting there in the darkness of your soul hunting for that word, that sentence, and it all comes together, you go, this is it. This is exactly what I want to say. And that gets communicated with people. Same thing happens with photography. You're trying to find a visual language that is relatable. And, you know, because of working with Geographic through, you know, people that speak a lot of different languages. So when you combine the right words, the right pictures, the right moving pictures with the right music and the right story, you have a recipe for being able to get into a person's brain and change not just the way they think, but the way they act. And that's, you know, there's a term for it that the neurologists call it. I'll think of it in a minute, but it's like...
Neuroplasticity.
Thank you.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's, they say too, it only takes about 90 minutes to change the way, not just the way people think, but the way they act. Mm. And that's about what our documentaries are. That's just by coincidence. It's not that, you know, we try to make it just that point, but that's usually the point where you run out of steam with a documentary.
The bridge from changing how somebody thinks to changing how they act, like that's the real, like, trick to unlock, right? You might be able to shift their perspective momentarily, but, you know, short of some real neuroplastic changes, you're going to snap back into whatever's convenient or some behavior pattern that you're just inured to over time.
There's a lot of thought that goes, well, first of all, there's different kinds of changes, right? There's like scientific changes, you know, Tony Saba, you know, the futurist. He shows a wonderful photograph. I think it's on the Easter Parade of 1900 in New York City, looking down Broadway. And it's all horses, except for one car. And I had a great-grandmother on my wife's side that lived in New York. She was born in the 1880s. She lived to 104. And she talked about New York being a really unpleasant place to live with all those horses. You imagine 300,000 horses, 20,000 tons of manure dumped evenly over the streets, you know, every day. So it goes onto your shoes, it gets into your house and the sidewalks, there's flies everywhere. Sailors could smell it 6 miles away in New York City. And so when this one car, you can imagine all those people in that photograph that were riding the horses, looking over at that crazy guy with the car, thinking, well, who would be caught dead doing that? And, you know, the Easter Parade of 1913, when Tony Saba does his talk, it's completely reversed. It's all cars, a single horse.
Yeah.
And that kind of transformation happens in about 10-year increments. And he said, well, you know, you think that was like a bet when he gave that talk, that when I first heard it in about 2010, there was an environmentalist. He was talking to a bunch of environmentalists, and I was one of them. And I was like, why doesn't the world understand the genius of an electric car? At that point, I had one of the first three electric cars in all of Colorado. I was powered by 114 solar panels. It was a fully electric Toyota. It wasn't a Land Cruiser, the
RAV4.
RAV4. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my license plate said VUS. It was the opposite of SUV. It stood for Vehicle Using Sun.
Yeah.
And
did you hang on to that plate? You still have that?
I don't. I sold it, you know. But I remember when Tony gave that talk, he was saying the same thing was happening. He said, people aren't programmed for these big changes that are coming. They happen really quick. And all you look back at, you know, the pundits, and they're all saying, like, you know, it's not scalable, it's not going to happen. And, you know, when I had it, that Toyota RAV was a 2002 Toyota RAV. So I was a real early adopter. And I remember thinking, like, why don't people get it? And Tony said, well, it happens very quickly. Most people can't see it coming. I mean, he got a standing ovation. And I just ran into Tony a couple months ago, and he said the same thing's happening with plant-based diets. People say it's not scalable. It is. It's totally there. You know, the whole agriculture industry runs on just a few percentage points of profitability. You take away their subsidies or their profitability, this new thing takes over, and all of a sudden the world's changed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, another example he gave is the, you know, remember, this is a 2010 talk that he did, and he's talking about the, you know, cell phones, which were just a few years old at that point. He said, remember, just a few years ago, 2007, we were hitting the number two key 6 times on our flip phone to text a capital C.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. But I think it's also a function of other elements lining up. There's a timing aspect to it too. And I think the electric car is a perfect example of the point I'd like to illustrate, which is there's a difference between what the right thing to do is, the altruistic thing, the thing that is in, you know, everybody's best interest. But it's another thing altogether when that product is packaged in a very aspirational way. And so when Elon Musk comes around and he creates this product that suddenly everybody desires because it's better, it looks better, it performs better, it's cool, there's a brand element that, you know, gets baked into it, that changes the public's perception of this thing that they had always looked at as, you know, kind of this weird outlier thing that only, you know, strange people would have in their driveway.
Exactly.
I mean, the economics of it, right? As well as the marketing and the kind of mindset around it.
Yeah. I mean, I know Leilani's been on your to the race car drivers on, you know, you've been on this podcast and she's now on my board. And I picked up, we did a film called Racing Extinction. We had I think it was a 2015. Oh man, it was
a Model S. One of the original
Model S's.
Right, one of the original Model S's.
And it was the first Model S to have a vegan, you know, leather seats. Anyway, it'd be way before 2015, because in 2012, we were going to be interviewing Elon Musk in October. And I remember him giving me a call and saying, can we make it for December instead? And at that point, I was like, you know, a little bit, you know, let down that, you know, we're not going to do the interview when I thought we were going to. I said, sure, but why? He said, well, I could go bankrupt. Now, 10 years later, he's the richest guy in the world. You know, so I'm hoping that there's changes coming, and there's changes coming quick. And, you know, it does have, there's a process to it. Like, you're doing it for the, you know, the right reasons. And then when society gets to about 30% of adoption, then other people are doing it just because other people are doing it. Mm-hmm. So 70% of the population is really, they're followers, which is fine, but they're not doing it for all the same reasons. They're just doing it because it's cool. But Leilani Mutter, we drove that car off the Tesla lot. You know, this is a woman who is comfortable driving, you know, gasoline powered cars at 200 miles an hour at, you know, Daytona and Talladega racetracks. And we weren't a mile outside the lot, and she goes, or the factory, and she turns to me and said, every other car on the road just became a relic. And it's taken, you know, a good 10 years for it to happen. But those are the same increments that mm-hmm. Tony Sabo was talking about.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I want to talk about the changes that are happening and the changes that are needed. But I want to stick to this idea that you're introducing around the power of storytelling to provoke change at scale. And, you know, I think you represent, you know, an interesting creator in the space of documentary filmmaking. And when I think about the history of documentaries, it also wasn't that long ago that documentaries were sort of considered an art form in which an objective person would tell a story from different points of view. And there seemed to be a premium or an expectation on this idea of objectivity, right? And it wasn't until, and maybe that's not true, maybe that's just apocryphal because everybody's subjective and everybody who would be interested in enough in a subject matter to make a documentary about it probably has a point of view that they're trying to express. But in popular culture, it wasn't really until Michael Moore came around and started making these mainstream documentaries where he had a very strong point of view that kind of shifted the fulcrum of what a documentary could be. And you're somebody who goes into these subject matters and these terrains very intentional about what you want to say and the story that you want to tell to provoke a certain type of reaction in the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I went to journalism school, and that was the goal back then, right? You tell both sides of the story, like there's only two sides to a story. But certainly all the writers I was interested in, the photographers I was interested in, all those authors of those original content had an opinion. It's like, you know, they said something, they had something to say. It wasn't, you know, the facts. It's like, you know, you can go get the facts. I want to know what you're thinking, right? That's the cool part. Not just tell me about, like, who are the players? What are their interests? What are, you know, what are their goals? What are they trying to do? And then they have somebody with an opinion. It's like, okay, then I can still take the opposite opinion, but I want to know what they think. And that's quite different than being, you know, an objective truth seeker.
Right.
And what I'm trying to do is, I got to say, when we did, you know, the first film I worked on was called The Cove. And I went out with that intention, like at their side of the story. When I went to Taiji, Japan, where they were killing more dolphins than any other place on the planet, I was there with the intention of not showing what goes on in The Cove. I went to the mayor of the town and the city council, sat with them for 5 hours the first day and 7 hours the second day with the Dolphin Hunting Union. Because I just wanted to get one person to come on camera and just talk about what they do. And I was going to do this bigger story about ocean health. I wasn't interested in that. But when they wouldn't talk to me, you know, after investing all that time of like, you know, why won't you talk to us? I was like, they must be hiding something. There's a story there that might be worth telling. And I remember sitting above this park, it's called Tsunami Park, above the cove, and looking down on it and thinking, like, what goes on in there would be really interesting. And then I had this, like, I can remember this feeling, this light bulb moment, like, if we can sneak in there and show it, that would be exciting. Mm-hmm. And I remember it all became very, everything came into focus to me. It's like, us getting in to photograph that would be so exciting. If you could transfer the excitement that I was feeling to the audience, now that's a story.
Right.
No matter what happens right in there.
And you certainly accomplished that. I mean, it has this narrative three-act structure, and it operates, you've said this before, people have described it as sort of Jason Bourne meets Flipper. And it does function like a thriller where your lives are at stake, you are doing illegal things, there is a very real threat hanging over you at all times, and you have to, you know, develop gadgetry and special cameras, et cetera, to, you know, pull off what's sort of an Ocean's 11 type heist to get this footage to document the atrocities that are happening, you know, in that cove. So maybe explain a little bit about, you know, Taiji and what was going on there, and what it was that you were, you know, kind of pulling covers on.
Yeah, well, I mean, it all started, if we can go back, I mean, the origin story of OPS, my organization, and I'll try to get quickly to Rickleberry in the Cove, is my best...
You don't have to go quickly.
Oh, okay,
we got
cool.
Time.
Okay, well...
Because the story is, the more I dive into your life, you're quickly becoming the most interesting man alive. And in case I forget, I want to talk about your photography career later, because I don't feel like people appreciate that chapter of your career, because it's been so overshadowed by what you do now, but there's some really amazing stuff there too.
Yeah, I mean, I was a good photographer. I mean, I was the first new photographer National Geographic hired in more than a decade. This is back in 1980, and you know, the first I've been a champion of lost causes even before that.
Well, you were winning photography awards when you were like 14 and 15.
Right.
You started working, you know, in that field, and newspaper, you got a scholarship to University of Missouri, and there was a sponsor to your scholarship.
Oh, Goldfinger?
Yeah, the real life Goldfinger. So like the whole Ian Fleming thing that, you know, becomes kind of a recurring, you know, motif in your films, that seed was planted when you were very young, which I find fascinating.
It's been an interesting trajectory. I mean, I don't know how far you want to go back, but, you know, that was like, you know, when I was a kid, just, you know, delivering newspapers as like a 12-year-old with wagons, you know, 75, like Sunday, you know, newspapers up hills. And you're waiting as a kid at 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning for the news, you know, your batch of papers to come off the press. So you smell the ink, you see the news coming, and you're part of that delivery system, albeit just a newspaper boy, but you're still feel part of that system at the very, very lowest ranks. So delivering the papers gave me like a really interesting background. In that little town newspaper in Dubuque, Iowa, they had a really crack team of photographers that were winning national contests. And I thought, this, you know, the first thing you do is you see the front page, and sure, they have a bigger picture. You know, it was like the photo staff was run by a managing editor that used to be a photographer, so it got prominence. And so that played into that, you know, that whole childhood thing. So I started working for that newspaper when I was 14. That was my first internship with them. I did that for a couple of years. And then, at Geographic, there was a famous, director of photography, Bob Gilka. Actually, I named my son after him. He was like a father figure to him, to me. And I wrote him back then they took two internships by portfolio, where you gave him, you know, sample your work, and one by winning college photographer of the year. So a junior year in college, I sent a portfolio, and he wrote me a really nice handwritten letter back saying, internships are for kids that aren't, you know, good enough to work. You're good enough to get in the industry. Good luck. And I thought, oh God, I always wanted to work for National Geographic my entire life. Like, you know, now that was my one shot. And then, so I realized there was the one shot I had left was to win College Photographer of the Year. And so I just applied myself. I was actually working here in town at the LA Times as an intern. And it just, like, you know, it was just, you know, 24/7. That's all I wanted to do, like news and sports. And that wasn't ego so much, maybe mostly when I was a kid, but I just loved to shoot. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you're working for a newspaper, you can do everything. And, you know, as a 20-year-old kid with, or I don't know, maybe an 18-year-old kid with all that energy, you just like, you know, the staffers were like, hey, kid, you got to take time off. It's like you're making us all look bad.
Uh-huh. But yeah, I can get away with it. You got the energy.
But I won that contest. I won like every category that there was in the College Photographer of the Year. So Gilka had to hire me for the summer. And I ended up doing a black and white story on the Powder River Basin, which was an energy part of the developing energy coal town area, you know, the Powder River Basin. And then that was being, you know, it was formerly ranch land, but now it's like, you know, coal property. And I, you know, that was rated the best story of the issue. That was my internship was going to be over. And there's this friend of mine who was laying out the magazine, Bill Dothit, and he's a little bit older than me, and he had a wicked sense of humor. And we would, back then, Geographic had, 1980, had this relentlessly optimistic viewpoint about everything. They could make Uganda look like, back then with the Civil War going on, look like a great place to live. Mm. And we'd make fun out of the magazine. Like, they'd do a story on, like, a couple walks across America, you know, to find the real America.
I know the son of those people. I know that issue. Go ahead.
And we do like bulldozer across America. and we think of all the, you know, the pictures that you would do. Like,
the counter narrative.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he came up with the story, like, our friend the maggot, life goes on inside a corpse. You get the idea. Mm-hmm. And one day we were watching, towards the end of my internship, we were watching this person, you know, haul the trash across the lunchroom. And he said, oh, we should do a story about, you know, garbage, you know, and there could be like somebody looking, you know, at modern garbage. And I said, oh, I know this guy, Bill Ratche. I just read about him, who was a garbologist. He was a Mayan archaeologist, and he's looks at modern garbage to see what people throw away and study it. And he said, well, we could do something on, you know, there's a guy, Fred Ward, who did commodity stories for the magazine. You know, he did like gold, silver, platinum, you know, and so we could do garbage. And it was like a Fred Ward style where he'd always have like art that was done,
right,
you know, with, and then, you know, he said, well, we could do like garbage art. And I said, well, I just remember reading about this colony of like artists up in Northern California that were taking art from garbage and making it into, you know, sellable art. And so we proposed the story, and, you know, Geographic took it, and then they hired me. But back then, and you know, the idea wasn't just to do a story. It's like, in 1980, there wasn't any mandatory recycling program in all of America. There's one. There's one, in Mountain View, California. And that, to me, that was insane, that we're throwing away aluminum and paper and glass and not even a hope of recycling, when the rest of the world, they have, you know, they are recycling. They're doing, you know, I called the story urban ore. And so the idea is, how do you take something that's, you know, people aren't thinking about and make it interesting? And that story became the most popular story of that year. Mm. And so the Geographic ended up hiring me after it got published. Well, you know, to not after it got published, but, you know, to do that story. And then I just kept on doing stories that, you know, had this sort of lost.
Right. Well, you were the youngest ever full-time photographer hired by Nat Geo, and also they hadn't hired a photographer in like 10 years, right?
Right.
So it's not a small thing. And there was some quote about like, well, if this kid can make garbage look beautiful, like we need to, you know, tie him up. He's got to work here. But that idea of, you know, taking something that people don't think about and making them think about it or turning it into something beautiful. I mean, that is also a recurring kind of motif in the films, like this sensibility was there from the get-go.
Yeah, and I can remember thinking, like, you know, all my friends were at, you know, my colleagues at that time were thinking, they were taking stuff that would be intrinsically interesting, you know, like animals. Uh-huh. Like, and my mindset back then was, how easy is that, you know, to photograph something that everybody wants to see? The trick to me was like, how do you take something that nobody wants to look at and do the reverse of it? Make it interesting, because they need to. You know, we need to look at it. And it just changed the mindset. Now, of course, I know there's a huge amount of talent and research that goes into making anything look amazing. But back then, like, you know, I wasn't trying to do stories on Paris or, you know, these, you know, beautiful places on the planet. I was looking at, you know, the worst places and try to make it look interesting, or try to, you know, find something in it that was that made us think about ourselves.
But at some point, you pivot into portraiture of like all these high net worth tech people, right? Like part of this information revolution, and you start working for Fortune and other publications.
Yeah, in 1997, I basically called it quits with National Geographic for a lot of different reasons. You can Google it. But no, it was okay. It was all right. We parted on a good company. But anyway, I made this transition to working, you know, shooting covers for Fortune magazine, which was, you know, it might seem like a downgrade after National Geographic, but, you know, I've always been interested in, you know, innovators. And I was meeting some of the most, you know, interesting people on the planet, you know, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Andy Grove, you know, all the, one point I'd photographed, you know, seven of the top 10 richest people in the world. And it's not just that they're rich, it's just that all those people are doing something interesting for culture, because, and they've got this other kind of drive, another kind of mindset. But the person I wanted to meet most back then, when I started working for Geographic, I did a story on the information revolution. Started researching in 1993. And Jim Clark was a kind of a combination of probably Elon Musk and Steve Jobs. He was the only person at that point that had taken three industries from scratch and made them all worth over $1 billion. Silicon Graphics was the first 3D graphics engine, the way that you could create, you know, anything on a computer in real time in 3D.
Hollywood, changed a lot of industries. It allowed you to like model your designs.
Right. Yeah, and gaming could be done in real time. The day he quit that, he started Netscape, the first commercial internet browser. And then he started WebMD, which is a way to revolutionize the healthcare industry by digitizing it. Because about 75% of the transactions you do are actually involved in just the clerical work of taking those forms and making them digital. He said, well, just do a digital in the first place and doctors can, you know, find out the latest research. And he did all that. So Fortune, I couldn't photograph him for National Geographic. He was just way too busy. And then, I don't know, fast forward like 5 or 6 years when I'm working for Fortune, they said, do you want to go photograph Jim Clark? He's built this new boat over in Amsterdam. I said, God, I wanted to meet this guy forever. And so I went over there. And Jim had just built this boat that, you know, everything could be controlled by the computer. It was like the world's largest, you know, mast at that point. Beautiful sailing boat. You know, he had like a Picasso from the Blue Period in the living room. He had a, you know, Rodin sculpture.
Hyperion, right? Is that,
yeah.
Like the mast was like 200 feet tall or something like that?
It was 192 or something like that. Michael Lewis did a book on him called The Nunu Thing. I was on that voyage from Africa to Antigua. But the point is, like, when I went to go meet Jim, he was starting a fourth company called Shutterfly, the way you can take digital prints and make analog, you know, prints out of them. And he wanted to become a good photographer. He said, Lou, would you teach me how to be a good photographer? And I said, Jim, I'll teach you how to be a great one if you teach me how to be a billionaire. And he would literally pick me up on his plane, and we'd fly all over the world and take pictures, mostly underwater. And at that point, he was digital, and I was like one of the last people to, you know, not do Kodachrome because that was the best film out there. And I was like, why would you do a 7 or 12 megapixel camera when you can shoot still with, you know? It wasn't that I was a snob about it. It's just, it wasn't as
tech
good.
Tech wasn't there yet.
And there was a medium format technology. So you have 35 millimeter, which is kind of like, you know, what we used at Geographic, an amateur would use, a professional amateur would use it to a 35 millimeter film, but medium format sensor is better, right? The bigger, the better.
Yeah.
And the same has always been true with film as well. 4x5 negative is better than a 35 millimeter negative, 4x5 inch. And Jim said, why doesn't somebody build a camera, like a good camera for medium format for underwater? I said, well, it's too expensive. Well, anyway, Jim built one for me. He built like the world's best underwater camera. It's still the best underwater camera ever made. And we'd go around the world and film with it. And that was our job. You know, that was like, I was hanging out with him, going around the world, shooting mostly underwaters. And every time that we went to a new location, I remember he said, I'm going to take you to the best dive site I've ever been to. It was in off Papua New Guinea. We fly there. His boat's waiting for us. We sail for about a day and a half. I wake up in the morning, and there's these kids looking through the porthole window. They were in these little dugout canoes. You know, we're in the middle of nowhere. This is like an alien spaceship had just come. And I remember we went out in the dinghies, and Jim said, I'll go down first to make sure we're in the right spot. He dove on the GPS coordinates, and he comes back up, and he's like in tears. I said, what's up? He said, it's gone. It, you know, probably dynamite fishing or a bleaching event, but it was completely gone. Mm. And everywhere we had, you know, we remember we did this for about almost 10 years, 9 years diving around the world. And every time you go back to a place, you can see this degradation go on. There's less fish. We came up from a dive in the Galapagos in a marine sanctuary, and we were surrounded by illegal fishing boats. And I remember he said something to me like, you know, somebody should do something about this. I said, well, how about you and I? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, use your money and my eye and we'll make films. Because we had talked about, you know.
Yeah. You must have been thinking about that prior to him raising it, though.
Yeah, and he was, you know, thinking about it, too. He was looking at the photographs we were doing, and I would do, you know, I'd take a little video camera down, and I'd make, as a kind of a thank you to him, I'd make these little five-minute shorts, you know, of our trip, and they were pretty good. I really put some time into them and made them feel like
this was your film school.
That was my film school. Yeah. Well, actually, the film school came with. So he decides to bankroll me, right? In this nonprofit venture, right? You know, this is his idea of making me a billionaire. He's going to put me in a nonprofit yeah. business, and we'll do films.
Yeah, is he living up to his side of the bargain on this? I don't know.
Well. You know, I got to say, I do feel like the richest guy in the world right now. Because, you know, we can talk about that later, but there's nothing quite like being able to do what you want to do, which he's allowed me to do, which is try to, you know, do what I'm trying to do to change the world at scale. And he allowed me, he greased the way to make that happen. Now, remember that. But like I'm a you know, pretender syndrome, right? Imposter syndrome, right? I'm like, I've never made a film before. You know, beyond a 5 minute little, you know, family short, you know, family film. And I'm thinking, God, what am I going to take my buddy's money? And you see, when you're in that world, you start to see friends come and go because they have a new business prospect and they're, you know, they don't live up to it. And so I'm thinking, oh God, I could be one of those jerks that gets money out of the rich friend and then doesn't deliver. I remember we were on a new boat that he did. It was the world's largest private sailboat. It's called Athena. We're down in the Caribbean with our families on the boat. And my kid must have been about, I don't know, 9 years old at that point. My son, Sam, he's playing on the beach with another kid. Happens to be Steven Spielberg's kids, one of his kids. And Steven comes over to Jim's boat to me. Steven did Jurassic Park with, you know, the Silicon Graphics.
Yeah, okay. So he used Jim's equipment to make his big movies.
Right,
yeah.
Which was the first breakthrough movie, right?
So they were already buddies then, I would imagine.
No, they never met each other. Oh, which is, they knew of each other, but
you just,
you know,
think
they weren't
people at that, in, you know, who are orbiting at that altitude kind of all know each other.
Yeah, well, but for the next week, we were hanging out together, right? Mm-hmm. It was, you know, Spielberg's family would come over to the boat, and I was always trying to craft a way, like, to get him alone for a second so I could say, like, do you have any advice for a first-time filmmaker? And when I did, he said, yeah, never make a movie involving boats or animals. And I'm starting the Oceanic Preservation Society, and, you know, everything.
Nothing about that.
Yeah, and of course, then we, you know, the first film we do is The Cove, and it's about dolphin hunting, and, like, how are you going to make that into a film? And the film that Jim and I, you know, we set off to make was actually the second film, Racing Extinction, and the dolphin hunting was going to be just part of it. It wasn't going to be, you know, a whole movie in itself. It was only after we started, you know, doing this undercover footage in Taiji, Japan, that we realized that there was a way to talk about what was going on there in that film and talk about the oceans, this bigger story. And that was kind of the aha moment.
We're brought to you today by On. I am a total gearhead. I love researching the latest technology for the sports I enjoy. And I've learned that people often overlook apparel. But what you wear isn't just clothes. It is, without a doubt, technology. Technology that can make or break a performance. And I can tell you, after spending 2 full days meeting with the apparel wizards at On Labs in Zurich, that On is innovating in this space like no other, with next-gen premium fabrics and just this heightened level of sophistication and precision and testing and development and intentionality previously unheard of that puts them just miles beyond the competition. I've been rocking On's high-performance running apparel, including the long tees, the weather jackets, even the climate jacket, all super lightweight, tailor fit, built to move, and just gorgeous to get you out and get it done in fleetfoot comfort, no matter the weather. I'm super proud to be a brand partner with this impressive team, From increasing product sustainability to improved energy return and impact protection, truly Swiss innovation at its finest. To get you moving, On is offering an exclusive 10% discount. To redeem, head over to on.com/richroll and use code RICHROLL10 at checkout. I'm super proud to announce my next venture, Voicing Change Media. This beautiful consortium of thinkers, storytellers, artists, and visionaries all committed to fostering meaningful exchanges and sharing thought-provoking content. Voicing Change Media will feature shows like The Proof with Simon Hill, Soul Boom with Rainn Wilson, Mentor Buffet with Alexi Pappas, Feel Better, Live More with Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, and The Conversation with Amanda Decadene. You can explore this network and all its offerings at voicingchange.media. It's really smart because by limiting your focus or narrowing your focus on one specific situation or event that allows you to talk about the broader issues at play creates a situation in which you can drive that level of emotional engagement and get people to really care when it's difficult to do that when you're at 10,000 feet and you're, you know, shooting statistics at them and you're kind of toggling back and forth from all different places all over the world. It's that idea of like the world stops when, you know, there's one girl at the bottom of a well somewhere in, you know, I don't know, some remote village. But we, you know, are challenged to even blink when we see a headline about a genocide somewhere that's far away from where we live.
Yeah, Christoph, wasn't it, you know, from the writer for the New York Times, he said that, like, you know, if you could, you know, get the audience to care about one person, then at the end of it, you know, he's always saying, but there's 3 million just like her.
Yeah.
You know, that's the key, isn't it, to find that emotional hook. And then you're still bringing in those big picture 20, you know, 10,000 foot views, mm-hmm. you know, as the stakes. You know, in the Cove, you know, it's about what they're doing, which is horrible, but it's also in that film we talk about overfishing, because the fishermen in Taiji, they rationalize that they're killing the dolphins because they're eating all their fish.
Mm-hmm.
What, it's not, you know, the dolphins eating all the fish. It's
right.
The, you know, the 145 million people in Japan that eat almost nothing but, mm-hmm. and all the Americans. And, you know, the 8.5 billion people on the, or 8 billion people on the planet now, a lot of them are pescatarians, and you know, these are wild animals. You know, it's like,
I believe those fishermen did believe that, though.
I do too. I think, but
they had to believe it in order to actually perpetrate those atrocities.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we all do that, right? We all rationalize a lot of our bad behavior because of, you know, whatever. I need to make mm-hmm. a living. You know, the social good. I remember, this is a funny story. Like, we were making the Cove, and I was going down to the IWC, the International Whaling Commission meeting down in Chile, and I wanted to interview the director of the IWC for Japan, and his name was Akira Nakamai. And this is why I know that if there is a God, he has they have a good sense of humor. So I'm on a flight from Dallas down to Chile, and they're holding the plane, and the plane is completely filled up. I can't even sit with my crew. But there's one seat empty next to me. And the last person to exit the door, we've been waiting for him to get onto another plane, is Akira Nakamai. And he comes down, he sits down right next to me. And I'm looking at my crew like, do you have any, like, they're looking at like, oh my God, like of all the, you know, all the gin joints in all the world, you know. And I waited till the plane took off because I didn't want him to be able to switch with maybe somebody that, you know, from his own team was on the film, on the plane. And then when we had dinner served, I turned to him and I said, do you have any idea who I am? He goes, no. He says, I know who you are. I want to show you a film. And we had like a 17-minute cut of The Cove that was like a sizzle reel. And this goes back to, okay, here's the guy that's responsible for dolphin quotas and whale quotas in Japan. About a week or two before, they were just caught illegally fishing bluefin to the tune of, you know, hundreds of tons mm-hmm. of illegally caught bluefin tuna. And so I had this opportunity to ask him, you know, anything I wanted to ask him. He's right there. Where's he going to go? He's a captive audience. I'm going to say, you're the guy that's, now back then, remember this, if you haven't seen the Cove, you know, part of the premise is that dolphin meat is all toxic. That's where we win. It's not just a matter of, you know, these are beautiful, sentient animals. Well, what are you doing killing them? Their meat's toxic. And they were force-feeding it to school kids in Japan. By force-feeding, you had to eat everything on your plate when you were a kid. You couldn't bring your own lunch.
They make you clean your plate, and you couldn't bring your own lunch, right? Like, you had to eat the mandated lunch.
Yeah.
And it was dolphin meat.
It was poison. Literally, it was poison. It had anywhere from 5 to 5,000 times more mercury if it was a fish, because it's a mammal. So they got by with this loophole. And I said to Akira Nakamai, I said, you're the guy that's responsible for, they had a plan to put dolphin meat on school lunch programs all over Japan, right before this happened. And I said, you're giving dolphin meat laced with mercury that's extremely deleterious effects to especially young kids. I said, how do you reconcile with what you're doing? He said, well, I'm in charge of food security, not food safety. Going back to your thing, like, we all make rationalizations.
The cognitive dissonance that you have to engage with to just get up in the morning and do your job. But is that the same guy in the Cove with like the grayish, longer hair?
No, that was his boss. No, Shoji, that was, worked underneath Akira.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that was it. End of discussion.
Well,
with that?
Yeah. I mean, he agreed to once we got to well.
And his argument would be, food security is an important issue in Japan because it's an island nation. They don't have, you know, grazing pasture lands like we have, et cetera. And it is a challenge to make sure that the however many 100 million plus people that live in Japan have adequate access to. Food.
Yeah, you could have written his playbook.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what he told me. He said we have 145 million people in Japan, about the same size as your California. Only 17% of our land is habitable to put our, you know, homes and, mm-hmm. and businesses. We have to look to the sea for our food. That's why we're illegally fishing tuna. That's why we're, you know, looking to, you know, to eat whales when the rest of the world is.
And just brazen with the fact that they're transgressing all of these laws.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, there was a rationale for everything.
It is so challenging. I rewatched The Cove last night to watch those scenes where you get these cameras into this cove, which is really, you know, basically they corral these dolphins, for people who haven't seen the movie, into this particular cove. They do that by banging on pipes and dolphins being very sensitive to sound. Out of fear, they sort of push them into this cove, and then they rope it off with nets, and then they just slaughter most of them, and they pick out a few that they then sell to the sort of marine entertainment complex, correct? And those animals fetch a pretty price, and the rest are used for food.
Exactly, and they make most. I think a dead dolphin, you know, on the meat counter sells for about $600, or used to $600 a piece, and a trained dolphin can sell for $150,000, maybe a quarter of a million now. And so that's the economics of it. And it's a very small town, and that really plays into, you know, it makes a lot of money for that industry, for that town, you know, by serving that industry. So those dolphins will go to the Middle East mostly, and China, and Japan. I think Japan had at that time over 50 dolphinariums.
Mm-hmm. The film ends up getting criticized for, kind of taking shots at like their culture, right? Like, this is our culture. How dare you? You slaughter pigs and cows, et cetera. Also, this food security issue sort of is used or deployed as a counterpoint to the issues that you're raising. But what's interesting is what you realize is that most people in Japan don't know this is going on. People in Taiji don't even know what's going on. And Taiji is this town that's like draped in all this iconography around whales and dolphins. Like, they're celebrating these beautiful animals,
but right underneath their feet. Right?
Yeah, like, this is what's actually happening. So Japan itself, the normal citizen in Japan, appeared to be just as surprised as any audience member who would watch your film.
Yeah, I mean, we got that early on, like, you know, culinary imperialism, they call it. And, you know, there's a certain amount of truth to that. But, you know, if your kids we're being force-fed toxic meat or toxic vegetables at your school. Wouldn't you be thrilled that anybody from any country would come in and tell you what's what when your country is covering it up?
You know, yeah, that's why the mercury argument is the strongest one in terms of, you know, kind of overriding everything else.
Yeah, Rick Rickleberry is the, you know, the protagonist of the film. He's the guy who captured and trained the five female dolphins that collectively played the part of Flipper for the Flipper TV series. We had a, you know, kind of a running thing between us. Whenever we talked to the Japanese media, we tried to use the word mercury in every sentence so they couldn't cut it out. They say, well, like, well, what about cows, pigs, and chickens? But I say, well, our chickens had that much mercury. We'd always like try to our creative way to try to bring it back to mercury because that was their Achilles heel. You couldn't argue mercury is good for kids. Mm. You know, they had the first big industrial accident in the world that was announced was Minamata Bay. Minamata disease. It's not a disease. This company called Chiso Minamata was intentionally dumping mercury into the bay and infecting tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And that got discovered in the 1950s. And, you know, so mercury, and then they were found to be guilty.
Mm-hmm. And there are all these birth defects, pregnant women ingesting this. And
yeah, I can remember there was a researcher, I think from America, that would study mercury poisoning here in America. And he went over to Japan. Remember, this is post-World War II. And that part of Japan, you couldn't easily get to. I don't think there was roads back then. So he got there by boat and he got to this bay and everybody looked like they had mercury poisoning. It's like, you can imagine, looks like you're deformed. You know, all sorts of birth defects. So it hits the older people too, but the kids have the most deleterious effect. Mm. And so that's how it was discovered. The government was helping this company try to cover it up. They were found guilty. So mercury is a trigger word.
Right, so in Japan, everybody knows about this.
Yeah,
and they're
deal.
Sensitive to it. And then on a personal level, I mean, this is part of your own kind of awakening, your own mercury poisoning.
Yeah, well, I interviewed the doctor who developed a test to find out how much damages the people that were affected are due. And he developed something called a two-point nodal test, which is like a protractor with two points on it. And depending on the distance you can feel the two points on a fingertip, he could pretty accurately tell you how much mercury poison you had. Then he showed me the corollary of what that would, because he had the brains of people after they died, they would, you know, take their brains out and he had brain slices and it looked like Swiss cheese. It would literally develop holes in your brain.
Wow.
And I remember asking him, what's that mean to have this disease? And he said, it slowly erases what it means to be human. It takes away your senses. It takes away your memory, your sense of touch, your sense of hearing, you know, all your senses start to go. And then when,
terrifying.
You know, so this is in my mind. Now, at that time, I was a pescatarian. I ate fish and I was delighted to be in Japan because I could eat fish, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I wasn't like, you know, when I was working for Fortune magazine, I did a story on the biggest independently owned slaughterhouses in America. And one was in Oklahoma and it was so big, they had their own slaughterhouse, like 500 cows a day would go through there. And I spent several hours there. And one of these cows, if you ever know about the process, you know, there's a reason why they say if slaughterhouses had glass walls, it'd be, you know.
Hence the gag laws.
Yeah. And they put what's called a captive bolt to the head of a cow, and that's supposed to kill them instantly. I remember this one cow was, they chain him up by his back heels and they rip off the hide. And then they start to slowly, as it goes around through these, it's like the reverse of a car manufacturing plant. They're deassembling the cow, you know, at stations instead of putting it together. And remember this cow comes by at the first turn and it's turning its head as looking at me hanging upside down. I realized it was still conscious. It was still
skinned alive and still alive.
Yeah, it must
with
have
a bolt in its head, but not dead. Like a old country, no country for old men.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was horrifying. And I thought, I can't be party of this industry. But I ate fish. I thought, well, I'll have to eat. You have to eat fish to be, you know, human. You have to have animal products. So I ate fish. I thought, well, they're going to be less sentient, intelligent. And so I was a pescatarian. So this is 1986, and this is when I'm doing The Cove would have been like 2007 and something like that, 2008. And I remember I was eating a lot of fish back then. I thought, well, I should have, one of the last scenes we do in the movie is we take the deputy minister of fisheries, Hideki Morinouki, and we take a hair sample because he can do blood samples mm-hmm. or you can do hair samples to figure out how much mercury somebody has. So we clipped his hair, you know, with his permission. And I sent it in. He took it into his lab and I didn't tell him whose samples they were, but he said Hideki's sample was like 8 times higher than what's considered too high.
Wow.
And he said, who's this other sample? I said, it's mine. He says, well, yours is 44 times higher.
Ooh.
And having seen what it does to the brain of somebody with mercury poisoning, the shock went through me like.
And you're in the middle of making this movie about this very subject.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, what am I going to eat?
Yeah.
You know, cause like I would imagine it's probably like what the Japanese would have thought. What are you going to eat if you can't eat fish? And I remember, I had to cut out, you know, eating fish because it wasn't a joke. It wasn't just like something I do later. Because to me, it was real palpable to see the brain slices and say this could be done, mm-hmm. be going on with mine.
You were asymptomatic though.
I had symptoms. I had like a short-term memory loss. I had this pain in my shoulder that was persistent, would never go away. I thought it was like from lifting cameras or something. And when I stopped eating fish, it has a half-life in your body, mercury, of about 70 to 90 days. And after a couple months, it went away. And I was like,
wow.
This is serious. And I was here for the Academy Awards. We were doing this run-up, you know, all the media mm-hmm. push. And I remember sitting with Rebecca Meek. She was a designer, a vegan, you know, clothing designer. She was like a friend of this guy that I met. And I happened to be at lunch with her, and she starts ordering off the menu, working with the waiter to try to, you know, make a dish. And I was like, are you vegetarian? She goes, no, I'm vegan. I go, what do you eat? She goes, everything else.
Uh-huh.
And she, you know, she explained that, you know, that's where do you think the animals get their protein from? Where do they get their nutrients from? And when her dish came, it looked better than anything that we all had on our plates. And that was it. I think
that was it. That was your lightning bolt.
The aha moment. Yeah. Of like, okay, you don't have to do this.
Interesting. It's interesting that happened in the wake of making that movie and not prior to it. Like you had your own journey with all of this.
Too long. That's too stupid. You know, there's a line, I think it was one of the best lines in the movie from Rick O'Berry. He said, I was as ignorant as I could be for as long as I could be.
Yeah.
About what he's talking about when he was training dolphins.
That guy's amazing. You know, I'm old enough to remember Flipper, and I loved Flipper. I had my favorite thing when I was a kid. I had a brass belt buckle that was a dolphin. Like it's still my spirit animal. Like I just love dolphins. And his story just haunts me of training those 5 dolphins to be Flipper for that show. And, you know, believing that what he was doing was ethically sound at the time. And then when the show's over, the dolphins get, you know, sent away to these, they weren't going to like SeaWorld, right? But they were going to tank somewhere.
Miami Sea Aquarium.
Yeah. That's where they were. And then he goes and he visits Catherine. Was that the name of the main one? Kathy. And Kathy pops up and they lock eyes. Kathy looks at him, takes a breath, and goes down to the bottom of the tank and decides not to take another breath. And dolphins being animals that don't have an involuntary kind of breath impulse, it's a choice, basically commits suicide.
Yeah.
Which is just, I can't stop thinking about that.
Yeah, it gives me chills still. And whenever I see that part of the movie, and it's like, it's those kind of moments, like if you're doing a big film, let's say on Ocean Health, you don't have that. I mean, that feeling that you have right now that hopefully the audience feels, like this animal committing suicide, swam into his arms, looked at him in the eyes and swam down to the bottom of the tank, committed suicide. You know, you can imagine what it would be like to be that, you know, that animal. You can imagine, like, I think everybody can imagine what it would be like to be alone without your own species mm-hmm. in a miserable tank, you know. And all, you know, at that moment, you're with Rick. you want him to succeed. He becomes a hero right then. And those transformational moments, you just can't get when you're just doing a normal documentary, let's say in the Nova way. Yeah. I don't want to criticize Nova. I watch all those, Novas. I watch, the Marvel films.
The Attenborough sort of style of documentary nature storytelling.
Yeah, and Attenborough for a long time. I mean, I watched those documentaries too, but, and I've been to those places that he's talking about. And in those oases, those ever diminishing oases where you can see the sardine run, you can see the migration, they're still out there, albeit now it's going through more urban areas, and you can still make it, if you frame it, you can make it look like they're still there. And to the audience, you're doing a little bit of a disservice by saying the world is, isn't changed.
It's a bit like greenwashing, because it makes us feel better about what's happening when we see that beauty, and then we're less likely to take action.
Yeah, I mean, that's my feeling. I mean, I love watching, all those wildlife documentaries. I love the courage that it takes to be embedded with these animals and see them on their own terms. But at the same time, I'm going, what can I do to try to halt that change? There's a word for it where they, you have these diminishing ecosystems that, in every generation adapts to the successive demise of the one created before it, shifting baseline. Mm-hmm. And, is it just Pollyanna to say, hey, well, this is just inevitable. We're destined as human beings to oversee the demise of the world. That's just the way it is. Or can you be part of this mechanism that can create a change? Is there a scientific, reason why everybody will eventually go vegan or adapt to a more compassionate world? And I think there is. I think there is there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of signals I'm getting that we can go that way. And I think films can edge us towards that eventuality. When we did that film, they were killing 23,000 dolphins and porpoises every year in Japan for human consumption. Mm-hmm. In the last year I looked, it was like 2 years ago, I think they killed 1,610. So it was down over like 93% since mm-hmm. we started that film. So films are very, very powerful weapons for social change. And that's why I do what we're doing. We had, telling Rickleberry's story had a profound effect on that industry. They're still capturing them for the entertainment industry. There's still, there's whole countries that are, have been banning it. You said it here before that it's, progress is never a straight line. It's messy. Life is mm-hmm. messy. There's ups and downs, but, I'm hopeful enough about, where we're going to feel like we can be part of the mechanism that pushes us towards a better society.
Yeah, I've heard your films described, I don't know whether this is your term or not, as weapons of mass instruction.
Construction.
Construction? Instruction, isn't it? Weapons of mass instruction?
Yeah, well, it's a destruction, construction.
Destruction, yeah. Construction, which I love. It's like, how can I deploy, how can I weaponize storytelling for a specific aim and do it in a compelling way? And that's sort of, your approach to these films, and they are impactful. I mean, The Cove, certainly they're not serving dolphin meat for school lunch anymore in Japan. And I know, you put your life and the life of your crew in peril to make that movie, and that was not easy. And you can't go back to Japan, can you? Can you go back? Have you been back?
I can go back.
You can go back?
I just can't get back out, probably.
And there was a period of time where it was unclear whether the movie was even going to screen in Japan, right? It has since.
Yeah, well, what happened was, I wish there was a famous, I think it was one of the famous Spanish directors, I believe, was doing the Tokyo International Film Festival.
Iñárritu, I think it was.
Yeah, and he said, if you don't show The Cove because they were doing a green carpet instead of a green carpet, because they were trying to make like a green. He says, if you don't show the Cove, I'm going to quit and there's going to be an international protest. So I went. And so I went over to Japan with my attorney, and we get off the plane, and like, I'm not talking about like in the terminal, I'm talking about on the gangway. It's like the first, like when the, you know, that passageway from, you know, the plane, there's presses lined there taking pictures of me getting off the plane. And they're saying, you know, asking me questions, like they're all people behind me. And I'm thinking like, oh, I am going to get arrested. This is, you know, this is not going to be pleasant. And so we were escorted under police protection. We, you know, I walked the red carpet, but I was totally alone. There wasn't a single person there.
They Nobody wanted the place to be anywhere near you.
No, they cleared it out. They made it so that it was going to be, you know, they're going to make a point that nobody's going to see this film if we can help it. But I remember at the screening, there was a lot of the people from the International Whaling Commission meeting from Japan were there. The whalers, the dolphin hunters were in the back of the room. And we had a night vision camera in the theater. And I remember the previous head of the IWC for Japan, I think he was educated at Yale or Oxford, you know, Western educated. And he was expert at crafting his rebuttal about the need to, you know, for Japan to still do whaling in, you know, defense of the dwindling number of whales. Mm-hmm. And I remember this when the killing scene starts in the Cove. I remember looking at this guy, and he's looking at the film, and he just goes like this in his seat. He just goes, covers his hands with his face with his hands, and he's shaking it like, you know, the world just changed. There's nothing you could do. He just knew there was nothing you could say about that.
It's done, you know? That guy. The IWC, the International Whaling Commission, these governing bodies, the MSC, what is that, the Marine Safety Council Commission, something like that, are problematic. I mean, there's so much corruption. It's one thing to be boots on the ground, grassroots, activism, you know, locality by locality, and try to, you know, coalesce a movement out of that through film and you know, other various means of raising awareness. But at the from a top-down perspective, you have these governing bodies that are just, I mean, just so patently on their face, blatantly corrupt. And the scenes in the Cove where we see that Japan is literally paying these failing, small, developing, bankrupt nations to vote, you know, in lockstep with them on these measures around whaling and the dolphin trade. It's just, it's so obvious to everybody, and yet, despite being out in the open, continues to happen. And then I think there was even more recently with the MSC and whaling in Iceland, et cetera. Like, it's like, can't we just all get behind the fact that we shouldn't be killing whales and dolphins?
I think we're heading that way. You know, Iceland, I think they're 2025. They said it's going to be their last year doing it. I mean, it is happening. It doesn't happen as quickly as I would want, but I'm, you know, if they're killing one dolphin for human consumption, that's too much. But still, when you have to, you know, take these victories that we have and celebrate them. Because if you only focus on the negative bits, like the, you know, the three countries that are still doing it, you know.
Are you able to hold on to that level of hope and optimism? I mean, the Cove came out in 2009. It's 2023. Like, when you look back, how much progress has been made? What still, you know, has yet to happen that maybe you thought would have happened by now? Like, when you look at, you know, that world.
Yeah, I guess it's the captivity trade. You would think that, because that's the economic engine that drives that. They're not killing them because, you know, for $600 a dolphin, it doesn't pay for the gas. Yeah. They're doing it for the captive dolphin industry. And you'd think that once people, you know, and over in Asia, you know, China, Japan, Middle East, if they saw, you know, I guess we need a Blackfish, another film about, you know, sort of dolphin intelligence, dolphin rights. I don't know. I don't know how to.
Because that industry is booming in China and in the Middle East as well.
The Middle East. I haven't followed it in the last couple of years. I know with the pandemic, they were failing, but now maybe it's bounced back even more. I mean, we certainly were part of a group that got that, we got things moving in the right direction on that. I'm on other things right now. I'm thinking like, okay, this can work. How do we use the same storytelling chops on these other bigger issues and scale it so that, you know, we can see serious progress on, you know, food systems, mm-hmm. on health.
Right.
And that's what I'm focusing in right now. And that sort of was like almost a trial balloon to show that it does work. You know, we have people working on that still in our business, but it's like, you know, the other side of it is it takes a lot of money to keep these doors open. You know, right. We have, you know, people need to get paid. And how do you, the movie didn't make a lot of money.
You know, it's people, amazing. Yeah. You make this movie, The Cove, the first movie you've ever made, you win the Oscar for it. And you didn't make any money.
Well, you know, we made enough money to pay back, yeah, some of the debts that, uh-huh, we had to do it. But it's, you know, I tell people that want to get involved in a documentary, the first thing I lead with is, if you intend to make money off of investing in a documentary, you're better off taking your money to Vegas, because, uh-huh, your odds are better there. But if you want to change the world, there's no better place, yeah, to come than us.
Yeah. It is the most effective way to provoke change, I think. And, you know, to onward to your second movie, Racing Extinction, which I think is a better movie. Cinematically more beautiful. And obviously you learned a few things about filmmaking. Like, it's very compelling. But I don't know that it was seen as much as The Cove. Is that true? Like, that just,
well,
it feels like it slipped under the radar a little bit more than The Cove.
38 million people saw it the first day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was on Discovery. Discovery, which is the biggest network in the world at that time anyway, they had access to 2.5 billion people. They did something unprecedented in their history. They released it on every channel they had, starting for a 24-hour period, starting in New Zealand. And, you know, when the sun came, mm-hmm, up, they showed it all day long until it came up in California. And then I think 38 million people saw it those first two days. And, you know, so it had a big push, but, mm-hmm, then it fell off the radar. Mm-hmm. It's like they have 400 films, or this, you know, it became part of their content. We just got it back recently. And it's hard to, you know, to pump it back. 38 million was a good number. If those were paying customers, yeah, oh my God, that would be like, if we had $10 for every, you know, person that came through the door. You know, our focus has never been about making money. You know, it's like, you know, we run a nonprofit organization, not that we're trying to lose people's money, but it was like, I don't want to like walk into a convention and have to hide my head because there's four investors that, you know, I told them that you're going to double your money or whatever. It's just not our goal. So we try to find people that are mission driven, and that, you know, we can focus on making a film. You know, mm-hmm, the business model for making a documentary is completely broken. Now, let's say you have an average Marvel film, $100 million, probably more like $200 million. They're going to advertise it. They have to get everybody in the theater to come on those first weekend or two. You have to spend another $100 to $200 million to get people to come to it. Mm-hmm. And how are you going to do that with a documentary? How can you compete?
No, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. And I also think the streamers have shifted focus away from documentaries, particularly hot button documentaries, I've noticed. Netflix being a place originally that was this incredible home for new documentaries, birthing new filmmakers and really putting that mode of filmmaking like on the radar in a very mainstream way. And we saw this great success of so many documentaries in the early days of Netflix. But now I think the streamers are so focused on new subscribers all across the world in areas like Saudi Arabia and China, that they're much more hesitant to onboard a documentary that might cause a political headache, no matter how good or high quality the documentary is. I had Brian Fogel on, who did Icarus, and then when he made The Dissident, nobody would touch it. He won an Oscar for Netflix, and they were like, we can't take this movie. You know, so things have changed. And so for someone like yourself, who's ruffling feathers, who's trying to say, have difficult conversations, it feels like the streaming ecosystem isn't as hospitable as it once was, which makes, you know, kind of threading the needle even more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually doing a series for Netflix right now on food. It is a lot of hard issues, and I've been finding that it is working. It's been, you know,
you've been working on that for a long time.
Ever since, probably since 2016, you know, I was trying to raise the money independently, went the Netflix route, but it's turned around in the last week, and it's like, I'm really, like, excited and happy that they're really going for it. They're pushing it. It's not complete control, but I don't know if I'm, you know, I'm a big fan of, I don't want to be the only one deciding what's going to be out there. We show our, like, I like to show to audiences, you know, I want a lot of control to the writers, the producers, the editors are certainly, you know, the ones, you know, driving the ship at that point, and you give notes, and the notes are coming back. And part of it, the reason I'm not confident in this process, it's the second time I've done a film where you never met the editors. Like last week, I was up at, everybody came to the office, the folks from Netflix and the editors. I'm meeting them for the first time. I've been working on this thing with them for 2 years, and I've never met them in the flesh. And usually I'm sitting literally every day, you know, that we're editing, I'm in the editing room with an editor, and now we're giving notes, and to come back in a week later, and, you know.
And the editor is the final author of the whole thing. I mean, they have incredible control over actually what it's going to be.
Yeah, and they're a little bit, to be honest, they're a little bit more, you know, Netflix has Final Cut. And, you know, they're paying the bills, you know, through us, but they're paying the bills. So they're like, you know, their allegiance is to the streamer. And luckily we have a good team at Netflix. That's, you know, I don't know if it did any good, but I did, you know, when I was in Indonesia with a really limited, you know, bandwidth a couple of weeks ago. And I just said, listen, this is not why I'm in this business. You know, we have to raise the stakes every time. I gave my, you know, as a heart and speech as I can. Maybe I found out later that they had already implemented those changes, but I'm like in the middle of nowhere. Like literally, it's like without, you know, and I'm seeing this cut. And it took me probably 7 hours to watch a 45-minute cut of an episode because it just wasn't the bandwidth. I had to stay up late when nobody else is using the system because we're with a small satellite dish. And I'm like looking at this and I'm like, oh my God, this is horrible. I'll never, you know, work in this business again. But it's just, then when I saw the final one, when I got back to stateside, it's like, I didn't have to make that talk. They already made the changes and it's back on the rails. But boy, it's a different world. COVID, everybody's working from, you know, they get conditioned to working from home now. And it's like, nobody wants to go back to sit in an office. And that's, to me, that's where a lot of the magic happens. You know, it's like in the field, it's a great creative process. You have wonderful DPs and people that you're up there doing it, the work. And when you're not in the room with somebody, it's different. It's really different. Yeah. I can't say it's better. I miss it. And who knows what? There's a lot of the great things that happen when you're in a room with somebody and you're just having lunch and you say, you know what about that scene? Can we just try moving this over a little bit? And then if you have to explain it to somebody or worse, explain it to like with 15 other people on a Zoom call, it's a laborious process. But it's changed. It's the world that we're living in.
Yeah. I feel like it's moving back though. I think that rubber band is snapping back a little bit. And you're right. I mean, there's no replacement for the energy that this. I don't do Zoom. Yeah, I am going to shorten the table. I get a lot of criticism. We moved it long, like when COVID happened, and I still wanted to do in-person conversations, and it stayed that way. And people are like, I can't believe how long your table is. So anyway, that's a whole other thing. I get it. But I'm glad to hear that. Is Food 2.0 a series or is it just a documentary?
It's a series.
It's a series, yeah. Right? What's the premiere window for this?
Be January of this coming year.
Are you allowed to talk about the subject matter explore? Or we can talk generally about food and sustainable food
just
systems.
Generally, I mean, you know, after the Game Changers, a lot of people saw that film. And that film really, you know, first of all, I got to say, that film had an enormous boost in the community. You know, I'm told that Merrill Lynch did a study last December, not this, but this previous one, the one before it, and they said that 75% of the worldwide interest in plant-based diet is because of that film.
It's unbelievable. And it's a credit to the entire team that made that film. And Game Changers was incredibly impactful. It was exquisitely rendered and very meaningful, not just for the movement, but for, you know, really shifting people's opinions and perspectives around diet, particularly for a lot of men who get caught up in what they're eating and how that affects their athletic performance, to show a very different reality in the most, you know, palpable way that really has made an incredible impact on culture. You know, to your point of, you know, weapons of mass instruction, like, it was extraordinary. I mean, it was really a phenomenon when that movie came out, and I couldn't be happier that it made the impact that it has made and continues to make. I know there's going to be a second one, I guess.
Right. And I'm not involved with it, but yeah, I'm, you know, more power to it. But, you know, a lot of people came out of that movie and they said, they would tell me just anecdotally, like, oh, I was vegan. What about now? I said, well, I did it for about 3 months and fell off the wagon for whatever reason. I said, why? He said, well, I'm not an athlete. And
that's an extraordinary statement. Like, suddenly now this is the diet only for athletes? Like, that's quite a shift.
Even though there was a twist in that film where, you know, James's father almost dies of a heart attack. And so it does this whole other shift to, like, hey, this is not only good for athletes, it's good for, you know, civilians of normal eating to eat this way. It's a good healthful way. But so in response to that, I wanted to do a film that, you know, it's called Food 2.0 now. This working title will be changed to something else. But I mean, the premise of it is fairly simple. I wanted to address this idea. People said, oh, I'm Northern European, I'm black, I'm this, I'm that. My genetics are such that I have to eat this way. So I thought, well, what if you gave identical twins, one a healthy vegan diet, another one a healthy omnivore diet, and then we measured everything we possibly can, you know, from the usual stuff of blood pressure, cholesterol, weight, et cetera, but, like, you know, get into the epigenetics, mm-hmm. get into, you know, these new biological markers that we didn't have the tools with, you know, very well 7 years ago.
Like microbiome,
yeah,
things like that.
Yeah. And so we're working with Stanford University, and we have identical twins where we had this very rigorous.
Are you working with the Sonnenfelds?
I am.
You are. Excellent.
Yeah. And the Scherzeyes.
Oh, nice.
We're cognitive testing. And to me, it was like, okay, I don't know what the results are going to be, but, and people, you know, my plant-based friends were like, well, what if it doesn't work in your favor? It's like, well, I'm interested in the science. I want to find out what's going on in our bodies. Mm-hmm. And so if you take identical twins, you've taken out these variables, right? If you have, it's like a almost a perfect genetic test to see about the diet. Mm-hmm. So and some of them we're giving an athletic physical intervention to, so that we're testing those as well. But I can't tell the results, but it was fascinating. And some of the results, like the scientists over at Stanford, they were saying, save your money. You're not going to see anything happened in 8 weeks. It's not a long enough time frame. And now, I'm not going to tell you the results, but they've changed their parameters for studies now based on that one study.
Is Christopher Gardner involved in that?
You got it.
Yeah, right. He was here last week.
Yeah, well, they're kind of, I just look at your podcast and I just invited them all to be in the
I'm
movie.
Glad I could help you recruit all the people for your big TV show. No, that's amazing. I'm looking forward to that. How many episodes?
4.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm episode 4, the one of the new cuts just dropped, you know, as I was flying in this morning. So I'm really excited to see it, because that's like, you know, at the end of the day, I want people to look seriously at what they're putting in their mouths. There's no other thing in the world that we can do to give us agency over the environment, over personal health, over the welfare of other creatures than what you put in your mouth. To me, it's just like a no-brainer. But But how do you make that entertaining to people? It's like, you know, that's tough.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want it to look like, you know, vegan propaganda.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm thrilled with the process so far that, you know, we were really, you know, I was sweating bullets for about, you know, I'd say almost 2 years thinking, well, what if this, you know, this doesn't look good for, you know,
our because I've heard you've been talking about this for a long time and I was interested in what the status of it is.
Well, I'll tell you offline later.
Okay. Yeah, good. You know, you mentioned, you know, how difficult it is to, you know, sort of craft these challenging ideas around something that's entertaining and palatable. And it made me think of the recent Apple TV Plus series, Extrapolations. Have you watched that?
I didn't see it. I don't know about it. What is it?
It's this limited series that tackles climate change by casting its gaze into the future. And every episode is like 10 years later as like, you know, this graph of carbon emissions continues to go up and you kind of see the world the way that it would appear during that period of time. And each episode is sort of a standalone thing. A lot of talented people worked on this show. It looks like it was very expensive and the intentions are nothing but, you know, extraordinary. But to me, it ends up not really connecting because it's trying to be this important thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think it is, and I've watched it and I got a lot out of it, but I think there's a reason why, you know, someone like yourself hasn't seen it or maybe a larger audience hasn't seen it because it's missing that piece around really connecting with an audience in a very visceral, emotional way.
I tell other, you know, I'd say young directors that, you know, you have a choice. So do you want to be right or do you want to be effective? Because, you know, we're all indignant about the way that we think the world should be. But is that going to connect? Is that going to work? You know, is there what's the audience that doesn't think the way that you think how are they going to connect with this? Are they going to see it as propaganda? Are they going to think of it as like, is it entertaining? You know, Michael Moore, you know, he said, first rule of filmmaking is don't be boring. And you could say, oh, well, there's nothing more important than saving the world. But like, okay, well, you know, I'm very cognizant that, you know, everybody works, I'm assuming, pretty hard. They're tired. They get back from work and it's like they have a choice. What do you watch on television? Do you want to watch the new Marvel Star Wars thing? Which, by the way, I watch too. But like, you know, what's gonna make them click? You know, so there's a word of mouth that there's a scene in there that, you know, you got to see. You know that, and that's what I think we do well.
Mm-hmm.
I think visually, I'm always like putting way too much energy. But it's valuable energy into like, how do you make this scene give them something that they haven't seen before at the Cove? We put time-lapse cameras in the market at Skeegee. And, you know, it took us a month. We had to get permission from all five of the major brands that controlled that, plus Mitsubishi, which oversaw everything. So there's a lot of negotiated back and forth that happened to get that 1 minute scene in there. But it's still probably one of the best scenes about overfishing that I've ever seen, because it shows like this, you see the gates open up, you know, and then you see the light come in, the mm-hmm. tuna get out there, you see the smoke rise from the frozen fish, the buyers come in and they take them off and put them on the trucks, it goes dark, it happens the next day, you see this wave after wave of like, oh my God, these are giant bluefin tuna that are now endangered, and it's just a commodity. And, you know, it's just something that's visceral.
Yeah.
It's not, you could say that, but when you see it, it does something else. It clicks. You know, some writers can do that with humor. Mark Twain talked about the Philippine War back in, I think, the turn of his century, the 1900s. And, you know, it's all the atrocities of war that we thought about of Vietnam. But he's making us kind of laugh at ourselves. At our imperialistic nature, there's a way that you can communicate that where people can see themselves. He did it through humor. I do it through a visual language with the words and the music, and you know, with a big team of very talented people, more talented than me. But I'm the head bull goose loony that wrangles them all together so that we're all, you know, on a mission. And then we get us all in the room. We're thinking like, is this? I'm always thinking like, do we need those two frames? can we make this a little bit shorter? I'm feeling like the audience a little bit hesitating. Can we just make it speed up a little bit? Mm-hmm. Can we? And if you don't have those assets in the field, you're not going to create them in the editing room. And our writer, Mark Monroe, has written four of the films I've done. I said, we have the opposite problem that every other filmmaker has. We have too much good stuff. We have to kill a lot of our babies, they say. You know, stuff that we love, that we really worked hard to. But I'd rather have gone in the field and gotten those assets and gotten those stories so that when we're in the editing room, we're surrounded by a whole palette of beautiful scenes that we can put together to orchestrate to so we can dial in that those emotional moments so that we can find those hooks that'll get people, you know, hopefully going from one episode to the next. And that's exciting to me. It's like, you know, but you got to be doing it in the field. Mm-hmm. You have to be doing it from the creation. You're not going to be like, you're not going to find a, you know, a masterpiece, you know,
in the edit if you didn't shoot it.
Right.
Or you didn't think about it. Yeah, in Racing Extinction, it's getting the Tesla and kitting it out James Bond style with your team of wizards who are like, you know, this Q who are like, you know, creating all these, you know, add-ons to that car to allow you to project onto buildings and, you know, onto clouds and all the like. That becomes this, you know, massive, you know, kind of inflection point for popular awareness.
Yeah, and the car was like a transitional character to get us to the big projections. And let me explain that a little bit. Like, you know, the people who haven't seen the film, we took a Model S, one of the early editions, like you said, and made it into like a Bond car for the environment. It's the first car in the world to have an electroluminescent paint job. We could change the color of the car with a flick of a button. Never been done before. We had a forward-looking infrared camera, FLIR camera, that came out of the frunk on a robotic arm so we could see the invisible world of greenhouse gases. Out of the back, out of the hatch, we had a 20,000 lumen IMAX projector so we could project those images onto skyscrapers or mountaintops. We had disappearing license plates, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was a great hook for that. But what we were interested in doing is the whole premise of that, you know, it started here actually in LA, where at the beginning of the movie, Adi Gill does these projections. Right. He was
at the sushi restaurant.
Yeah. So at the you know, the Oscars and the Emmys, there'd be his screens that they would rent, you know, the like high-end screens to, you know, for the award ceremonies. And he put one of those, he had the business that rented those out to those places. So he had a screen that he put out in front of the Hump restaurant, which was illegally selling whale meat. Our team busted that restaurant, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is right during the Oscars for the Code, too. It was like, I remember there was
I didn't know that those time periods overlapped.
Oh, my
like
God.
That.
It was so funny. Because
I didn't even know the Hump was in L.A.
Oh, yeah. It was at the Santa Monica Airport.
They were selling all kinds of endangered, illegal fish in their sushi.
Whale meat. Yeah. Say whales. That was the third largest whale in the world. So we had heard about it. It became like this sort of urban legend. And we sent a couple of operatives into the restaurant, you know, it's 2 weeks. We were pretty, because the Cove was out in theaters. We hadn't yet won the Oscar, but we were doing a lot of press around town and stuff. And, you know, so we were kind of, I wouldn't say, many people would say, oh, you were the person from the movie about mm-hmm. it. So we didn't want to go in the sushi restaurant. So Heather Rally and this other woman, Crystal Galbraith, they went in and we gave them, like, you know, some of the last money that we had to order a lot of expensive sake and, you know, ingratiate yourself to the waiters and order, you know, the whale meat. And we were listening in the back of a car, you know, these transmissions going on when they ordered it. So when we got the story is, when we got this with this whale meat, we had the samples, and then we went to, God, I can't remember which agency it was. It was like Fish and Wildlife. There's a couple different agencies that were dealing with this. And we took the samples up to Monterey, to Fish and Wildlife. I think it was Fish and Wildlife. And they said, well, that's all fine and good, but you need a chain of custody. I said, what's that? And they said, well, we don't know that, you know, one of our people wasn't overseeing the sample. It's Saywell. We had to analyze the Saywell, but you could have just planted it. So it'd be your word against them. And they said, can you do come with us on a bust, you know, or get them to, you know, the same women? And we'd run out of money. Mm-hmm. And they went and tried to do a sting themselves, but they couldn't get the restaurant to sell them the meat. And so then when we were in LA for the Oscar roundup, We were getting a commendation from the mayor's office, you know, some award here in town. And I remember looking at it and said, like, we got our team here. We can do this thing. This is like 2 days before the Oscar. And there was actually a party that night at the mayor's mansion or wherever the mayor hangs out. And I remember like my wife at the time, she had like the distributor had like a limo and it was a big dolled up event.
Right.
And I said, well, you go ahead without me. I'm going to go do this thing. And she, I remember she, I love her, but she said, why don't you grow up? And I thought, well, this is what I was meant to do.
Who do you think I'm married to?
Oh, bless her heart. You know, I can see it. Like it was, this was like the one night that we could have to.
Sure. You can't take a day off to go to the Oscars.
I can't remember. The Oscars are on a Sunday night. We did this like on a Friday night or a Saturday night. And we had these three agents at the bar, at the sushi bar. Mm-hmm. Our women went in with their, the same women, two women, Heather and Crystal, went in and they did the buy. And then I remember we won the Oscar on Sunday night. On Monday morning, it's like front page news that we busted the Hump restaurant. So it all happened right at the same time.
That's
crazy. It was like this perfect story. And it wasn't just, the agency. Now, here's what was going on. I had a friend who was working at the U.S. IWC, the International Whaling Commission meeting, and he said that at the time, this might be complicated, but Obama, who we all love, was making a backroom deal with the Japanese to give them, open up commercial whaling in order to keep the bases open in Okinawa. That was the rhetoric I heard, and I thought, we have to press this because this deal's about to happen. So I want, if it became front page news that whale meat is being sold right here in America, we could shut down those talks.
Yeah, that would become radioactive for Obama.
So that's why we did. We jumped the gun. So like we didn't wait for the Fish and Wildlife and the U.S. Customs to go through, what they had to do a proper bust. We just announced it, and that was, that was it. And they were pissed off at us, but like to me, it wasn't about like them getting accolades for doing the bust. It was about trying to shut down this idea of opening up commercial whaling again. Mm. That was the reason for it. But that all happened about the same time.
That's wild, the compression of time on that. It's so wild to think about the fact that whaling still exists and that people are hunting and killing dolphins, these, magical, extraordinary, incredibly, intelligent animals. And if there was one thing in that extrapolation series that kind of stuck with me, there is a sequence in which, the oceans are completely acidified and the whales, I think there's like, maybe one or two whales left, but they have cracked the code in deciphering the language. Like they've got the technology to do that. So there's a sequence where somebody is in a, like in an underwater, there's a station and part of it's underwater and they're, communicating with this whale. And it made me think about the potential with AI and how quickly it's advancing right now in our capacity to figure out the nuances of how dolphins and whales, and other, other of these cetaceans, are communicating in a way that, maybe we could figure out.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like I mentioned Roger Payne. He's the guy that discovered that humpback whales are singing. So back in it was the 70s, he wrote a paper. And, whales use rhyme. They have meter. What they don't have is a start and a finish. It's a river of song. Like they'll have an 18-minute song, but they don't say okay and then start again. They'll keep on singing. So this was novel back in the 1970s, and National Geographic came out with a record called "Songs of the Humpback Whale." It's still the largest single pressing of a musical recording ever done. Bigger than the Beatles. Bigger than Elvis. Bigger than Taylor Swift. Don't hold me to that, but it was anyway. And that is what sparked the Save the Whale movement, and that helped create the moratorium for whaling. And Roger just died on Saturday, and so he knew he was going to die. And so I called him up on Thursday, it was the last day before his full day alive on the planet, and just told him what he meant to us, you know, how he moved things forward and how much I loved him. When I was working on the Cove and Jim had Athena, he gave me that boat to use for some of our first expeditions. And we went down to Silver Banks, which is where 80% of the North Atlantic humpback whales come to mate and give birth and to, you know, socialize. These five distinct pods from the Northern Atlantic come all down to the Silver Banks, about 70 miles north of the Dominican Republic. And Jim said, who do you want to invite? And my first guest was Roger Payne.
Mm.
So a couple of friends of mine have something called the Earth Species Project, where they're using AI to try to decipher language, and said, you got to meet Roger Payne. He's the guy that started it all. And his wife, Katie Payne, was actually the one who first figured it out, and then he wrote it up, and you know they worked it out together. But it was really Katie. And Katie, by the way, his ex-wife, is the one that discovered that not only whales use, you know, are singing, she's also one that discovered that elephants use infrasound, sound below our level of hearing to communicate. Now, this is fascinating.
I didn't know that.
Okay, get this. Yeah. So Roger was amazing. I spent a week with him on this boat. You know, an amazing boat, but the whole, he would put these hydrophones in the water as we were eating at this really fine boat, you know, three-masted schooner out in the middle of the water, and he'd be, and anywhere you put, now imagine there's thousands of whales there. It's only the males that sing, and they're singing, you know, to probably the same way that, you know, we sing, you know, to find mates, to, you know, get your tribe together. And you can hear these strange ethereal songs as we're having dinner, and they're right below us. There's like this alien universe singing right below the boat. And, you know, he would tell us about like blue whales. Blue whales, you know, most of their song happens below our level of singing. Like when I'm talking right now, if you saw it on an oscilloscope, it'd be like these little quick waves, right? My voice going up and down to each note. But the blue whales operate on a different metronome than you and I do. If you saw their song, through a computer screen, it looked like a straight line. But that straight line was really one of those squiggles, but it's like a kilometer long, because their notes, when the single note is like a kilometer long. So,
right.
you
have to speed it up and compress it.
You speed it up, and it sounds like birdsong. And because it's low infrasound, they use something called the deep ocean channel, where the colder water at the bottom, these waves propagate at the bottom, they bounce off the surface, and they can actually go on for thousands of miles. So these whales can communicate thousands of miles. One of the proteges of Roger Payne was this guy, Chris Clark, who was in Racing Extinction. And he was brought in. SOSUS is the underwater surveillance system that the Navy uses to detect submarines. And they started opening it up to scientists. And they brought Chris in to try to figure out what this one, what they call biological, was doing. And because at first they thought it was a submarine, like a Russian sub. It would go off in one direction. It was using the same frequency to ping that the submarines do. And it would go, it'd be noisy for like 6 or 7 minutes, then it would stop. And then it would be in a different direction. And he goes, well, that's not a submarine, that's a fin whale, and it's feeding.
Wow.
And he realized that SOSUS is this underwater string of hydrophones that the Navy strung along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, you know, roughly halfway between, you know, the eastern coast of America and Europe. And that's to detect, you know, boats. Every submarine and boat has a different signature. And they could, you know, they had somehow, they would put on these filters to take out the biologicals, and somehow this whale had, you know, developed a song, so it was singing at the same frequency as the subs were there. So anyway, Chris had realized that, you know, they had this filter on, and that if they took the filter off, he could see where a song was coming from all over the Atlantic Ocean. So they had him turn, he asked him to turn it off. And now the way he describes it, it was a secret bunker off in Norfolk or someplace over one of these bases. And it was like a basketball court size area with people with three screens. Remember, this is like in the early 90s where nobody had more than two screens.
Right.
And there's, you know, dozens of people with headphones all listening for Russian submarines. Now, Chris asked them on this big screen to turn off, you know, off the filter, to filter out the biologicals. He said it lit up like a Christmas tree for a few seconds, then it blew the computers. He realized that the whole ocean is full of song. that, you know, wherever, you know, wherever he put, where you go, you go to the Arctic and everywhere you put in a hydrophone, you hear cetaceans somewhere singing close by or far away. Because actually it's oxymoronic, but animals can, the sound travels about 4.5 to 5 times quicker underwater than it does on land. So, you know, and if you use these low waves, low frequency waves, you can transfer, you can see, you know,
they'll travel those great distances.
Like thousands of miles. In fact, Roger Payne thinks that these blue whales evolved so they could actually hear themselves clear around the world in the deepest, the longest part, like the Southern Ocean where there's no land mass. They can actually hear, you know, they can ostensibly hear themselves over 9,000 miles, a blue whale.
That's insane.
It is. Well, anyway.
That's crazy. And, I mean, just to know that completely changes your lens on like how you think of an animal like that.
Oh, there's a, when we had Roger on the boat, I'm trying to remember the story. Okay, there's a researcher. This what we're talking about is like a Rosetta Stone, right? It's like, so like AI is like a Rosetta Stone where you had like the ancient Greek and then you had the Egyptian hieroglyphs, right? I think that, wasn't that what was going on? They had basically, it was a ledger. Basically in ancient Greek and the hieroglyphs. And it was a way that they could figure out, okay, triangulate, like, what does this symbol mean to this word that we do know?
I see.
So that was like a key. Now, AI says, okay, we don't need to know anything about language. We'll just use these models that and somehow figure out what these animals are saying based on, you know, this very complex algorithm that we don't even know. But this, one of the researchers I had in the boat, with Roger, he put hydrophones in the water. There's a guy, Lou Herman from Hawaii. He was teaching dolphins tricks, two pairs of dolphins tricks. And you put your fingers together and go together. And then you do like a circular gesture, do a flip. And dolphins, I'm told, will readily get this. They'll do that nearly instantaneously to put fingers together, you know, flip your fingers in a circle, and the dolphins will swim to the bottom of the tank, come back up, they'll do a flip, and they'll get their reward. And then, you know, they would do this so well, he'd be like, okay, what if we said together, then he'd go like his hands spread apart, you know, like your mind said, be creative. So together, be creative. He said, no, they put a hydrophone in the water, but it was only one hydrophone, so they don't know what's being said. But the dolphins instantly went down to the bottom tank, did a flip, went back in the water, then they spit out water at the same time into the face of the researcher.
So they hatched a plot, basically.
Yeah.
And they agreed upon that.
But somewhere in there, in that language, in my mind, would be like, is spit water at the researcher in his face. You know what I mean? You could have deciphered it. So I would say use AI in a situation where you know what's going on rather than...
Right, to reverse engineer like what was communicated and understood.
Yeah, so like what they're doing right now, these friends of mine I put in touch with Roger Payne, is they're looking at, they're taking all the data from Cornell University or I think Scripps, where they have these hydrophones out in the water working right now, and they're trying to use AI to decipher what these animals are saying, but they run into what's called the cocktail problem. Like if this studio was full of dozens of people and then you're trying to isolate what people are saying, it's called the cocktail problem. Mm-hmm. What about if you just have two animals in a room and you have a hydrophone in each one of them so you know what's being communicated? Mm-hmm. That to me is like, but you know, that's why I'm a, you know, filmmaker and not a researcher.
Right. I mean, I would imagine that at some point they're going to figure it out. Like these tools are so powerful. It feels like it's only a matter of time before the technology advances enough and the science progresses where they're going to figure this out.
Yeah,
and that could be like a watershed moment in how we relate to, you know, this underwater kingdom that is so poorly misunderstood and we, you know, treat like the world's garbage can.
Yeah, well, imagine what, you know, if we could, well, first of all, you know, a lot of dolphin species and whale species have bigger brains than us. And they have
the dolphin brain is insane.
Yeah, and they have more, you know, convolutions of the gray matter. So there's more opportunities for, you know, synapses for more, you know, they have spindle neurons that are more spindle neurons that are associated with processing complex emotions. They got a lot going on up there. But, you know, we as humans, you know, we keep on changing the bar and say, well, they don't use tools. Well, you know, in fact, crows, chimps and a lot of other animals do use tools. But, you know, we keep on saying, you know, but they don't have computers, but they don't have podcasts. You know, it's like we're never analyzing or valuing an animal for how well it survives in its environment. Mm-hmm. And you look at like, okay, so we have these big brains. And sometimes you can, you know, intelligence could be how well does a species work within the confines or the barriers of their own ecosystem? Or do they try to impinge that? You know, if you eat all, you know, if you consume all the resources, is that intelligence?
I mean, you know, we're failing pretty miserably when it comes to that metric.
Yeah, I think so.
They're perfectly adapted to their environment. It's because they don't, unlike humans, they're not crafting their environment. They're not changing their environment.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, you know, development over the last 4.5 billion years of human history. But I was talking to one scientist, and he said, "Well, you know, the Earth is going to be fine without us." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, the Earth is always changing. You know, the advent of blue-green algae created oxygen, and it gave us. And there's a lot of winners and losers when oxygen became, you know, one of the chemicals in the atmosphere." And I said to him, "But blue-green algae didn't have a choice. You know, we're at the cusp of what they call the Anthropocene. You know, the sixth major extinction on the planet. There's been 5 of them, all caused by you know, either geologic or meteorological, you know, issues, asteroids, and those are all events that, you know, one species wasn't in control of. But we have a choice, unlike, you know, a wild animal." And that's what maybe is different about us. And to me, the question becomes, how quick can we all figure that out so that we're making choices that are, you know, good for the environment, you know? And
so how do you think about solutions with this idea, you know, humankind is the asteroid in this equation, in this, you know, mass species extinction event?
That's act one.
And there's
one.
No, what's that?
That's act one.
Yeah, that's, okay, so we're in act one. You know, I don't want to have to experience the bottom of Act Two, where everything feels hopeless, and somehow at the last minute we figure out how to solve this problem. We have solutions to pretty much all of these problems. It's the implementation of these solutions. It's, you know, activating, you know, a base of enough people to be adopters of these solutions, and then it's the top-down, you know, political will conversation around getting everybody corralled into, you know, one mindset around solving this problem.
Well,
or this series of problems.
There's some really good evidence and science that shows that social change happens when you have 10% of the population 100% committed to the truth. And that's, you know, that's what happened with electric cars. That's what happened with cell phones. That's what happened, you know, the suffragette movement. That's what happened with civil rights movement. And then, like we said earlier, that's when you get to 30%, that's when people are doing it just because it's been normalized. I think that trying to get these movements up to the 10% so that it's unstoppable is part of my job. And that's one reason, by the way, we do the projection events. You know, when, you know, films like, you know, the films that we, let's say Racing Extinction, 38 million people the first weekend, the first night, that's great, but that's not 700 million people, which is, you know, or 800 million people, mm-hmm. which is 10% of the population of the planet. That's why we do the projection events. With the projection events, we found, and I knew this at the point from Leilani Munter. She said, she's the one that, you know, showed me these first studies. And I read the study, and I called up the lead researcher, because there was 3 pages of algorithms, some math that I just didn't understand. It was never in my strong suit. And I said to him, "Can you give this to me in lay language, what this means, what this paper means? Because I understand what 10% of the population means, 100%, but I don't, you know, understand the why of all this math." He said, "Well, it's like if you're trying to create steam, it'll never happen unless you get water up to a boiling point." He said, 10% of the population, 100% committed, is the boiling point for the exchange of social ideas. And that I can understand. It's like, okay, but how do you reach 700 or 800 million people? With the projection events, we can do it. When we when we did Racing Extinction, we showed it at Sundance. We at that point, we had only projected on the United Nations, and it looked good. It looked beautiful. You know, the front of the UN, by the way, this was done with permission with the UN, with Ban Ki-moon, who was working on the 2014. This was the preamble to the Paris Accords.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked good, but the New York police said they would shut us down if we had over 2,000 people attend, because they were worried about 600,000 mm-hmm. activists in town and them storming the gates, whatever fantasy they had in their heads. So it never had that kind of momentum that I wanted. What I'd always wanted to do was to project on the Empire State Building, because I thought that was like, you know, to me, there's something symbolic about it. The UN's great, but if without a crowd, it was never going to resonate. And remember, Discovery at that point, they paid us all the money they were going to give us. It was going to cost like, $1.5 million to do a projection event. And they said, the film's good enough, don't worry about it. And I thought, well, we need to get a lot of people to see it. Otherwise, it'll just be like, another good movie. You know, that wasn't my objective. How do you change things? So they said, well, a projection event in August in New York, said all the important people are going to be in the Hamptons. They're going to be over in, over in Europe. It'll be a non-event. It gets dark late in New York, and so the press won't be there. They can't afford to pay overtime. It'll be a non-event. And so we did it. I raised the money. We did the event. And I remember we had rented out a bar overlooking the Empire State Building. And my son came up for it, and he goes, "Dad, there's people in the streets." And I thought he meant people in the streets waiting to get into the bar, because it was packed. And he goes, no, look over the side of the building." We looked over, and like Fifth Avenue, with all these projections going off endangered species on the Empire State Building, it was like the New York Easter Parade. It was just like, packed, like traffic was, was halted. So I went down to take a look, and they couldn't hear the music. They didn't know what was going on up there. They just saw something extraordinary, and they all had phones. They all had, everybody became a photographer. And we had some media show up, but like the cops said, "Hey, if this gets too crazy, we're going to have to shut it down." But it took me 4 years to get permission from the city to do those projections. And we had 939 million media views by Thursday. It was the top trending story on Facebook and Twitter for 4 days worldwide.
Wow.
And we thought, it was on the cover of the New York Times. It was, all the media, everybody picked up on it, and everybody had a cell phone, and that it got shared a lot.
We did. So yeah, billions and billions of eyeballs on us.
And then we thought we couldn't get any more attention to the subject than that of endangered species, in the Anthropocene. And then the Pope calls. And the Pope wanted us to project on the Vatican for his Laudato Si. This was in December. Mm. Why world leaders were meeting in Paris to talk about the Accords. Because remember, Pope Francis is named after St. Francis, mm-hmm. the patron saint of animals.
Animals, yeah.
So we did a projection event there, and it was so surreal, because we didn't meet with the Pope, but we met with his number two over at the Vatican previous, when we get the job to go do it. And he goes to me, I'm not going to be able to repeat his accent, but he goes, "If it was up to me, this wouldn't happen." And I said, "Why?" And he says, "Well, because the last artist to do anything on the Vatican was Michelangelo." And so there were 600 media there. We had, that whole square leading up to the Vatican was filled. I think 225,000 people saw it live. We had 4.4 billion media impressions just in the English language. And, at least in America, those projections help create laws that prevent some of the most endangered species from being trafficked on, through U.S. ports, which was, there was a loophole getting through. So that, and to me, we have another projection event that we'll find out what's going to happen tomorrow, but we're working on with the Empire State Building again, and the city of New York, who now wants us to come back, and we want it to be all about, three nights projection, one on food, one on solutions to climate change. And we know that we've reached nearly a billion people before with a three-night projection. We'll be able to build on that. So for me, this is a way to scale change. A movie is great. It's powerful. But a projection event is a way to cut through all the media hype. You don't have to pay for this either. Yeah. Instead of paying for advertising, you're getting people that want to share it. That's kind of the...
It's super powerful. And the artistry that goes into these projections, like, I don't know how you find these artists to kind of craft these displays, but they're really exquisite.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. It is, you know, it is, you know, we've got a lot of colleagues.
I mean, these should be, talk about scaling social change. I mean, you could just have projection events going on all over the world all the time.
That's the idea, because everybody has... What we've learned about projections, like you can pull up to, I don't know, a building in LA that's kind of dark and project on it, but like, so what? You know what I mean? There has to be some sort of symbolic meaning behind it. So when you project on the United Nations, it's like, this is the one building that represents the world coming together to look at big existential problems and solutions. The Empire State Building represents the pinnacle of, you know, city life and progress and, you know, capitalism. And then when you put animals on it, it sort of vibrates against that, what that means. You know what I mean? You're saying, this is important too. This is nature. You don't see it in the city, and now you're seeing it. And the kids are like, they didn't know what these animals were. They'd never seen them before. And you forget that. If you live in a city, your exposure to nature is really limited by like what you see on TV or maybe up in the Adirondacks or something, but you don't get to see like, you know, a golden lion tamarind or, you know, any of these creatures. So they all look like alien creatures. So,
right. I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, legacy, how you think about, you know, the meaning that you're leaving behind, et cetera. But I want to do that first. I want to preface that by asking you a little bit about this project that you did around joy with Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama. I have not yet seen that film, but I did read the book, and Doug Abrams is a very good friend of mine. We went to college together, and he's been on the podcast twice. So, I mean, Doug and I've known Doug since I was 18.
Really?
Yeah.
So
how did you get involved with that? And talk to me a little bit about that, and also how it's kind of maybe changed. Maybe it hasn't changed, but I would venture to imagine that it probably has kind of changed how you think about, you know, your work and your life.
Yeah, everything really. I mean, I was down in San Jose where Doug lives, and I was at a dinner with a lot of other people, and sitting a room full of really interesting people. And then halfway through, the host said, "Oh, now to mix it up, switch with other people on the other side of the room." I found myself sitting next to Doug, and I said, I didn't know him. I didn't go to school with him. I said, "What do you do?" He said, "Well, I'm a book publisher." I said, "Well, anything I would have heard of." He said, "Well, I'm probably best known for the Book of Joy." I said, "I love that book. That's amazing." He said, "What do you do?" I said, "Well, I'm a filmmaker. You know, what have you done?" I said, "Oh, the Cove." And I don't know if he even heard of it. And then he mentioned that they had documented that meeting between Desmond Tutu and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And he said, "Well, we have like 18 hours of footage over a 4.5-day period. Do you think it could be made into a film?" I said, "Well, let's take a look at it." And so I saw it in the raw form. And I found myself, as I was watching it, like having all these light bulb moments in my head about joy. Like what, you know, really figuring it. I know this podcast is full of now a lot of great people talking about what gives you joy. But what really resonated for me was like, yeah, of course, that's why I feel good when I do something that's not just for myself, when it's for others. It does feel good. It's what they call, you know, like a wise selfish. You know, when you're doing something good for you, it also feels good for me. And that's okay. It's like foolish selfish is when you're doing it only to get something out of somebody because it's transactional or it's like it's one-sided. And that did make me feel like, God, I wish I would have seen that a film like that, like, you know, when I was in my 20s. And so this is before the pandemic, and I said, yeah, I think we can, you know, cut footage, you know, we'll have to go back and, you know, re-engineer some of the stuff and, you know, film scenes with the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. And then COVID hit, and now all of a sudden we're trying to make a film like where you're afraid to go out of the country or you can't get into the country. And like I mentioned before, like, you know, I made that film with people who I'd never even met physically. I met Doug because he was right down the, you know, down the street, so to speak, you know, in California. But that film was like so important to me. You know, in my head, Like, you can't change society unless you figure out a way that you can communicate with them. Like, you can understand people and what does give them joy. And to me, that film was like I'd call it like chiropractic for the soul. You know, just everything snapped into place for me. Like, okay, this is, you know, how do you take, you know, one of the big takeaways from that film to me was like, you have these two spiritual leaders, two of the greatest spiritual leaders in the world, probably at that point, at this point still. How do you, you know, what do they have in common? You know, the Dalai Lama's 1,000-room palace, you know, with, you know, servants and, you know, could lead an army. And you have Desmond Tutu, born in the squalors of, you know, the slums of South Africa. But they both learned that out of this kind of grief is probably only possible to get really great joy. You know, you have to take a hardship and turn it, like, how can you turn this around? What's the silver lining in it? Because there's always a way to reframe it. You know, that's kind of a classic Buddhist thing, is reframing, you know, instead of what was me, like, okay, how do you turn that negative bit? I mean, like, look at your own journey. You know, you took, you know, being overweight and alcoholic and doing drugs into, you know, one of the most popular podcasts in the world. You know, it's without that, you probably wouldn't be here.
No.
Yeah.
No. There's no question about it. But finding that way to, you know, channel that pain to, you know, first of all, heal yourself, but then figuring out a way to give it back or to, you know, be of service and tying that, you know, somehow to things that you care about or problems that are greater than you in the world is, to my mind, like the Holy Grail. Like, if you can find something that you love that's also meaningful for other people and is solution-based for some of the problems that we face as individuals and as a collective, there's nothing more fulfilling in my life. And certainly, you know, you're living your life in that manner.
Yeah, I think, I mean... But the takeaway from all that was like, God, there's a lot of joy.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's it. That's the joy that when you think about the moments that really give you joy, that like lasting joy, and they talk a lot about that in the film, is like, you know, what kind of joy are we talking about? And so, you know, it's not like a permanent state of utopia. It's just those hits that you have when you're not on the right path, when you are giving back, when you are in service to the universe rather than just yourself. And then if you can just align yourself with this, you know, only bringing the people in that you want to talk to, or just, you know, narrowing in on the focus of like, we all have a limited amount of time on this planet, and like how you decide to use those and who you decide to share them with is probably the biggest decision that we can make. Right. You know, And making that your North Star, making that my North Star has certainly given me the more fulfillment that I ever knew was possible. In fact, that's why Jim Clark, I say, has made me the richest person in the world, because he did give me the opportunity to find that North Star that I don't think I would have had without him.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, I think on top of that, the joy provides a more sustainable fuel source to kind of pursue what it is that you care about long term. And I think what you see in the activist community in particular is you know, a very short term fuel source based on, you know, being upset with the state of the world and feeling like any self-care or experience of joy would be an indulgence because it's so dire and it requires all of your attention. And as a result, a lot of people burn out, or they just can't maintain that level of intensity in the work that they're doing. But to kind of disabuse people of the idea that you know, it's okay to experience joy in the midst of all of this, and in fact, if you can do that, it sets you up to be an even better servant in the short term, and gives you the ability to serve long term.
Well said.
It's hard though.
Yeah. Well, though. I mean, I think if you're on the path, though, I mean, you know when you can when you're pointed towards that North Star and you start to veer off, you know it.
Yeah.
You know, you
I
know
veer
you,
off a lot. Yeah. I'm a grouchy, resentful bastard. I got to let you go. But like, you have a lot of stuff you're working on, right? So you have this Food 2.0 show on Netflix that's coming up, we talked about. But you also have this She Change project with the female big wave surfers.
Right.
Which sounds pretty cool.
Great one. Four kick-ass women surfers. They got a pay parody in the sport of, you know, male-dominated sport of big wave surfing. Yeah, that's a great film. It's hard, you know, for some reason, it's hard to get funded, too. I mean, we're still struggling for that last million, but I think it's such a great film. It's not just about surfing. It's about women's...
It's about pay equity, right?
Yeah, pay equity. It's about women's rights. Mm-hmm. You know, it's there's that story. We're working on a film on, you know, on the Great Filter, and the Fermi paradox. You know about that?
The Fermi paradox. Is that the...
If there's aliens, where are they? And the Great Filter is maybe it's the DNA of life forms in the universe that they burn out of their resources before they have a chance to be able to communicate or travel great distances.
Interesting.
Yeah, and then doing a film on plastic pollution solutions. That's come a long ways. That's a great one.
A whole podcast on that.
Yeah, I saw that. That was great. Yeah.
And is that all of these are in different stages of production and development?
Yeah, I'd say, we're done filming the Food 2.0. We're about, I'd say, half done with the plastics film. I have a co-director of people, and you're like, how can you do all this? It's like, because I have a lot of great people that I work with. The She Change, I'm just an executive producer, you know, helping put the team together and raise the money. I'm doing a book project on still with that camera, you know, that Clark built for us. We just got back from Indonesia. We were there for about 2.5 weeks. We won't have to go on a big tangent, but boy, it's like, you know, we went to the place on the planet where you can see the most fish on a single dive. You go to the Caribbean, you're lucky to see 30 fish on a dive. You can see 300 down in this place called Raja Ampat, Western Papua New Guinea, owned by Indonesia, Irinjaya. And it's like 76% of the world's corals, hard corals, are found there. And soft corals. One of the dive guys said, when God said, let there be fishes, this is where he was standing. Just like the land before time. And it's really hard to get to. And, you know, we dive with rebreathers so we can stay down for like 2.5-3 hours at a time if we need to. It's a big video production, you know, with lights and cameras, but underwater. And then you can kind of wait for these tides to change. So you have this upwelling of plankton and the soft corals bloom and the fish come out. And it's really kind of amazing. And with this camera, you can see far more with your eye than you can with when you're actually there. It's just, you come back with these images and it's just extraordinary, beautiful. And part of it is to get a baseline. So, you know, even that place is starting to get hit by bleaching and you know, global warming, you know, just a 2-degree shift and an increase in temperatures and you lose the world's corals.
Yeah.
So we're at that cusp and, you know, we want to see a baseline of like, how beautiful was it? Because, you know, the next generation might not know what they lost because, you know, we're losing it. And I want to create a big book, like a Summa sized book on, you know, using this extraordinary camera to see something that people haven't seen before.
Wow.
And yeah, we have a couple other projects going on, you know, but it's like, I just love doing what we're doing because it's like, I mean, I kind of wish I would have been doing this when I was in my 20s, but then somebody said, well, you probably would have made shitty movies when you were in your 20s.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think it's cool that, I mean, how old were you when you made The Cove? Were you in your 50s?
50.
Yeah, late bloomer. There's hope for all of us out there. Like, first movie in your 50s, you win the Oscar. But I also think there's interesting new avenues of creation that are becoming available to help tell these stories and impact people. Like, I was thinking of Michael Mueller, the photographer turned filmmaker, and what he's doing with VR, with sharks, and, you know, being able to, you know, give a kid in a village a headset and have him feel like he's underwater swimming with the sharks. Easily, you could do that with the coral reefs and any number of these other, you know, kind of endangered areas that give people that real, you know, strong emotional connection.
Yeah, we're working on that.
Yeah.
We're looking at, you know, new capture techniques. In fact, I'm going up on Saturday to look at some people where people think big, up in Boston to work on a project that we could, you know, to me, it's all about scale. You know, it's that, how do you affect people quick with the amount of change that we need? And VR seems to be a good way to do it because mm-hmm. it's more immersive, it's more emotional. You maybe don't need 30 minutes or an hour and 30 minutes. Maybe you could do it in 20 minutes. One of the problems I have with VR is that it's hard to, you know, it's usually a one-off. It's like, you know, you need a set of goggles. You're not seeing it in a group. There's something that's transformative when you're seeing a movie with other people.
Sure, of course. Yeah, there is. It's still, it's not quite there yet. I get a little seasick wearing the thing and, you know, it's going to happen at some point. Well, I really love the work that you do. I think that you are, you know, a really important voice in this movement for so many reasons. And, you know, the movies that you've made have just been incredibly impactful to me personally and to millions of people across the world. And I can't wait to see what you create next. And I'd love to have you back when Food 2.0 comes out or the plastic. You know, I would love to talk to you about the plastic problem. I'm afraid to even ask one question because it'll be 2 hours. But yeah, I have so much respect for what you do. And more importantly, like the way that you do it, the intentionality that you bring to your projects and just the manner in which you comport yourself as a steward of the planet and an activist and a creative voice. So thank you for sharing.
Well, thanks for the accolades. But I mean, again, I got to say, it's a team effort. You know, it's like everybody involved is like, it's a process. It's like, you know, I get too much attention to what we do when it's really a team. But I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I love the podcast. It's like, it's my go-to when I, in a car, it comes on automatically. As soon as I open the car door, I start hearing your voice.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, man. I appreciate that. Cheers. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed the conversation. To learn more about today's guest, including links and resources related to everything discussed today, visit the episode page at richroll.com, where you can find the entire podcast archive, as well as podcast merch, my books, Finding Ultra, Voicing Change, and The Plant Power Way, as well as the Plant Power Meal Planner at meals.richroll.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, the easiest and most impactful thing you can do is to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on YouTube, and leave a review and or comment. Supporting the sponsors who support the show is also important and appreciated, and sharing the show or your favorite episode with friends or on social media is, of course, awesome and very helpful. And finally, for podcast updates, special offers on books, the meal planner, and other subjects, please subscribe to our newsletter, which you can find on the footer of any page at richroll.com. Today's show was produced and engineered by Jason Camiolo, with additional audio engineering by Kale Curtis. The video edition of the podcast was created by Blake Curtis, with assistance by our creative director, Dan Drake. Portraits by Davey Greenberg. Graphic and social media assets courtesy of Daniel Solis. Thank you, Georgia Whaley, for copywriting and website management. And of course, our theme music was created by Tyler Pyatt, Trapper Pyatt, and Harry Mathis. Appreciate the love. Love the support. See you back here soon. Peace. Plants. Namaste.